This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at WILL.UIUC.EDU. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. What does your dream home look like? Is it affordable? There's the rub. Well, maybe not. On the program today, we're going to talk with architecture critic and editor Carrie Jacobs. 3 years ago, she set out on a cross-country road trip to find a well-crafted and affordable home. She's written a book about her search. The title, The Perfect $100,000 House, A Trip Across America and Back in Pursuit of a Place to Call Home. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments for our guest, Carrie Jacobs. Maybe you have a story to share about looking for or building your perfect home. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That number is 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Carrie Jacobs was the founding editor of Dwell, a magazine about modern residential architecture and design. She has also been an architecture critic for New York Magazine. She currently writes a monthly column for Metropolis and is a regular contributor to Travel and Leisure. Her book, The Perfect $100,000 House, is published by Viking. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Carrie Jacobs, thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
My pleasure. Are you building?
Am I building?
Yeah.
Not at the moment, no.
Plans?
Well, I guess part of the problem is that I'm a one-income family supported by a freelance writer. And so my ability to build right now is a little bit limited, but I do have some options when I decide to build.
Yeah. And do you have many options?
I have several options. Probably not more than I could count on the fingers of one hand, but that's not too bad.
Yeah. And where are you making your home now? Where are you living? What's that
space
like?
I am in Brooklyn, New York right now.
Uh-huh.
I'm in downtown Brooklyn on the top floor of a 19-story building. So it's not exactly the perfect $100,000 house.
Yeah. It's livable, though?
Yeah. No, I actually like it here very much. And I have an apartment that faces south, and I can see the Verrazano Narrows Bridge and New York Harbor and the Statue of Liberty from where I am. So that's not bad at all.
That's good. That's good for a New Yorker.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's the amount of sunlight is unusual, actually, for New York.
Hmm.
Lots of New York apartments are a little bit like caves.
Yeah. What's your idea of a perfect house or a perfect home?
Well, my taste in architecture, as you can tell from the book, leans toward modernism. But when I was editing Dwell magazine, I worked very hard at finding a kind of modernism that was a little, I don't know, I don't want to use the word soft. At Dwell, we always talked about nice modernists, so it's not as hard-edged or rigorous as a lot of modernism can be. But I like open floor plans. I like, you might have been able to tell from the description of my apartment, I think sunlight, daylight is probably mm-hmm. the most important. I don't know, it's almost an architectural material. And what else? I guess I prefer, you know, kind of rectilinear buildings to things that are more irregularly shaped. In the book, I talk a little bit about the fact that in the end, one of my favorite houses actually has a very steeply pitched roof instead of a flat roof. And of course, modernists are supposed to prefer flat roofs, but I'm not sure that I do.
Hmm. Interesting.
So those are some things. Those are some basics.
Yeah. Well, let's go back to when you were living in New York before you moved to San Francisco, before you moved back to the East Coast. When you began this search, you had only owned one piece of real estate,
right.
An apartment in Manhattan. What was that space like?
Well, It was, I bought an apartment at the bottom of the market in New York, which was the mid-90s, in a 1960s glazed brick apartment building. There are a lot of these buildings in New York. The bricks are a little bit shiny, and they used to think that made the building waterproof. They were mistaken about that, but that's another story. And it was a kind of building that wasn't very fashionable at the time that I bought it, but then as kind of 1960s modernism became more of a thing, these buildings have actually taken on some of the appeal of, you know, pre-war buildings. In any case, it was at the corner of 3rd Avenue and 14th Street, which is possibly the noisiest intersection on the planet. And it was a nice-sized in New York, meaning over 700 square feet, one-bedroom apartment. And I looked out on 3rd Avenue, and there was an old theater called the Variety Photoplay Theater that was on the other side of the street, and I kind of liked being able to see that. Which is, of course, has since been torn down, and they're building a big condo building there. And I liked the place a lot. I had a solid wall, probably about, I don't know, 25 feet long of bookshelves, and I worked at home, and, you know, that was my spot.
Yeah. It sounds pretty nice. But you sold that apartment.
I sold that apartment, and it was probably one of the most foolish things I'd ever done, selling it. I mean, because I bought at the bottom of the market and I sold in early 2000, I did make, you know, a substantial amount of money on it, but it would have been wiser to hold on to it. But it's really the psychology of having sold the apartment that I think in large part motivated this book, because once I sold the place, I sort of felt as if I was homeless in a sort of existential way.
Yeah, you discovered owning a home was very important to you.
Yeah, which I really hadn't fully understood that before.
Yeah. So you moved then to San Francisco.
I moved to San Francisco. I rented an incredibly beautiful apartment in Pacific Heights in one of these sort of old kind of Art Deco buildings they have. It's probably the nicest apartment I've ever lived in. Possibly the nicest apartment I'll ever live in, and it never really felt like home to me.
Yeah.
And I spent about a year sort of inventing Dwell magazine and launched it in, I don't know, 2002, and spent another 2 years editing it and spent a lot of time looking at people's houses.
Yeah.
You know, and really great houses in many cases. And I also met, and I guess consciously collected a certain kind of architect. I found out that there were people out there who were really interested in how to build great, modern, inexpensive houses. And so I kind of kept, I don't know, something as formal as a file, but a list in my head of all of these architects.
Yeah. On the one hand, your personal and professional lives are dovetailing very nicely here. But, you know, as you point out, it was ironic. You'd sold your home to launch a magazine about homes. And then there was this moment that you came to call the Spider-Man epiphany.
Yeah, well, that was, I guess, the moment when I realized that I probably couldn't live in San Francisco anymore. Starting Dwell and running it for the first, the first 2.5 years I was in San Francisco was great fun. My chronology is a little off here, but after 9/11 happened, I was actually in Sweden when 9/11 happened. And my sense of home and what home is was really sharpened by that. I thought, you know, in part I think because in New York my life was so much about writing about big buildings and architecture, and I'd written about the World Trade Center in one context or another, my sense that New York was home was really reinforced by that, you know, by 9/11, And, you know, sometime in 2002, things at Dwell began to be more complicated and a little bit rocky. And one night after, you know, a long day at the office, I went to my neighborhood multiplex and saw the movie Spider-Man. And there's a scene, sort of a climactic scene in the movie where Spider-Man is having this aerial duel with, is it the Green Goblin? I can't even remember the name of the character. And it's over the 59th Street Bridge in New York. And at a certain point, Spider-Man is about to lose to the bad guy. And there are all these New Yorkers on the bridge who start throwing things. And I don't know where people on the 59th Street Bridge would get things to throw. But they started throwing things at the villain. And they said to, you know, the villain, "We're New Yorkers. You mess with one of us, you mess with all of us."
Yeah.
And I started crying. And I thought, okay.
I got to go home.
Yeah, it's time.
Yeah.
So.
When you were driving back to the East Coast, you're moving back to New York, and things started to settle down in your head. And I think that's the point where the idea for this book really was born.
Well, there was one thing that happened is before I left the West Coast, you know, the movers came and packed up my apartment, and I gave my cat, well, temporarily, I gave my cat to the cat sitter's brother-in-law for safekeeping for a little while. And I went up to a town called Bolinas, which is north of San Francisco a bit. It's sort of the south end of the Point Reyes Peninsula. It's a very beautiful part of California. And I had a house that I borrowed from a friend for a few days, and it was a little curved, very simple house. It had a kind of a curved shape, and the south wall was all glass, and it wasn't designed by an architect. It was kind of good hippie architecture. And I stayed there for a few days, and I thought, God, it would be nice to have a house like this. And then I started driving cross-country and noticed that long-distance driving can be almost like a form of meditation. And I began to relax, I think, for the first time in, you know, 6 months or a year. And so out of those two experiences, the little house in Bolinas and the pure pleasure of driving cross-country, I think the book was born.
Mm. How did you decide on $100,000?
Well, in a way, it's an arbitrary figure. In another way, some of the architects who, you know, in my file of the ones who like to build inexpensive houses, that was kind of a target figure for a couple of them. You know, is low enough to be challenging, but high enough to actually be possible. It also happened to be the amount of money I had left over from the sale of my apartment at that point. So it was, you know, what I could afford. Aside from having to live on something, it was in theory what I could afford at that moment. Later, I mean, there's a calculation I do in the book. But I didn't really do that till after I had picked the number and till fairly late in the game, which just shows that the median home or the average home size in America right now is 2,200 square feet, and the median home price, which has gone up and down a little bit in the last couple of months, well, it's gone up and up and up, and it's finally started to go down, but it was in the neighborhood of $220,000. Which was about $100 a square foot, and so and since my ideal home size is more in the 1,000 square foot range, $100,000 isn't that far fetched. But that calculation, which sounds logical and may or may not be logical, didn't come till later.
Hmm. When you began, what were your ideas about a perfect house? You mentioned earlier, you know, light and openness. What else was on your list when you began, and did that change over time?
Well, you know, when I started on my road, well, the first thing I did in the book and the trip for the book was that I went to this home building school in Vermont called Yes Tomorrow, a design build school. And one of the things they asked us to do in the course of the class there was to make a list of things that we were looking for. And I could read you that list if you want.
Why don't you, maybe some of the things that are on it.
Yeah, well, the list and in the order that the things occurred to me, and which would tell you a little bit something about my priorities, permanent home for books and papers. So in a way, almost, I think I was thinking about a house as a filing cabinet. Space to work, space to entertain and read, outdoor space. Double height main room with kitchen, dining room, living, and work areas. And this is something, one of the things that I talk about is even though I'm interested in a small house in terms of square footage, I was looking for something that would be enough, I don't know, be a bold enough architectural gesture that it would read bigger than it is. And so the double height main room, I think, is part of that. 1,000 square feet, master bedroom and guest room. I'm asking myself, garage or no garage, raised deck. Then I go through like whether I want passive solar, meaning, you know, windows, basically big windows facing south, whether I wanted to get into photovoltaic roof tiles, which I suppose might raise the cost of the house a little bit. I don't know. Those are some of the things.
Yeah, it is interesting. You know, years ago when my husband and I were in the market for a house, the real estate agent wanted to know, what are you looking for? And she said, you know, the first three things out of somebody's off the top of their head is what they really are looking for.
Uh-huh. Well, then there you go. I mean, one of the things that, I don't know, I guess it's true of where I live now and in general, is having a good workspace, because when I was at Dwell, of course, I had an office, but usually I work at home, and so workspace, I guess, is important to me. One of the things that we did at Yestermorrow that I thought was really interesting was a thing called a bubble diagram. And it's a way of taking the functions, the things that you think you'll be doing in your house, and putting them, mapping them on a piece of paper, not doing a formal floor plan, but just putting, you might say cooking or sleeping or entertaining, and you would sort of arrange the bubbles on a piece of paper the way you think they might work out in your ideal house. And it's a really interesting way of figuring out what your priorities are.
What kind of existing homes are available across the country for $100,000?
Well, it depends on what part of the country you're in. I know that in the Midwest there are lots of very lovely older homes on the market, in some cases for well under $100,000, depending on where you are. If you wanted to live in, say, South Dakota, you could probably get almost anything for under $100,000. In Texas and parts of Colorado, and I don't know, probably also in the Deep South, there are lots and lots of subdivisions built by the standard production home builders where you could get a little faux Tudor or a little faux Mediterranean house for under $100,000.
Well, recalling Spider-Man here, if you're a New Yorker or you're a Chicagoan or you're a, you know, prairie, like middle-sized city kind of person, you might be able to find a great house at a great price, but you're looking at living far from your landscape, far from your where your heart is.
Well, you know, the funny thing is that I did meet with an architect in Troy, New York, who is building houses in upstate New York, and I am considering land in the Catskills, which is not too far from here. But a funny thing happened a few weeks ago, which is that, you know, I did this road trip for the book, which is, you know, 14,000-plus miles driving all over the country looking for this obscure object of my desire. And I went a few weeks ago with an architect who is designing townhouses for a neighborhood called East New York in Brooklyn, which is a neighborhood that was famous or infamous in the 90s for being the murder capital of New York City. But a coalition of church groups has been building, pretty methodically, building single-family homes out there since the 80s, and the neighborhood has really turned around. And they're putting in really a new subdivision, which is an unusual thing in New York City, of townhouses. And they hired this really good architect to design. He didn't get to do too much with the insides of the houses, but just to give them a different exterior look, to make them a little bit sharper looking. So in any case, I went with this architect to the Brooklyn Navy Yard, which is, about half a mile from where I live. And there, in an old World War II shipbuilding foundry, was a company that was doing prefabricated housing modules, and they were building his townhouses. So in a way, and these townhouses are going to sell for $158,000, which is a subsidized amount. They probably, without the subsidy, they'd have to sell them for low $200,000. And, you know, there's a lottery to get them and so on. So I don't think realistically I could buy one, but it just struck me as funny that after all that driving, here was, you know, the almost perfect $158,000 house right in my backyard.
Right in your backyard, yeah. What's the future for prefab construction, and could that be a way that we could build more affordable homes?
Well, you know, the prefab movement has been gathering steam in recent years, and there seem to be more and more architects involved in trying to sell prefab houses. I think that the really important thing that's happened is the person I talk about in my book is a woman named Rocio Romero, mm-hmm. who is based in Perryville, Missouri, and she is selling the LV house for, I think, prices start. It's a kit, and prices start at about $30,000-$40,000, and that doesn't include some significant things like the cost of construction or the glass or the heating and plumbing. But in any case, for her, her big breakthrough was that she found a way to sell her services as an architect retail. Like a very small minority of the homes built in this country involve an architect at all, and mm-hmm. most people never, ever deal with architects.
Mm-hmm.
But what she figured out was a way to sell her services retail. But on the other hand, what she's doing is not particularly high-tech, and it's not really mass production. You know, she can build, I think, a handful of houses a month, you know, three houses, six houses, something like that. And it's pretty traditional, her building methods. And so when people talk about prefab, they have this fantasy that there's some, you know, fabulous high-tech high-tech factory out there that's just kind of spitting houses out. And that doesn't exist, not in this country, at least. So what the prefab movement really needs for it to be real, for it really to be, you know, manufactured, well, or mass production, is investment. You know, millions or perhaps billions of dollars would have to go into creating factories to actually build houses, because the manufactured home industry in this country, it's really pretty typical stick frame houses, except they're being built indoors. You know, it's not an assembly line. It's not the automotive industry. So there are more and more architects who are retailing their services the way Rocio Romero is. I just got a press release from a company called Marmel Radziner. They're out of Los Angeles, and they're very well known for having done the restoration of some very famous modernist houses in Palm Springs and Southern California. And now they're selling a prefab home of their own design in a subdivision outside Palm Springs, but the prices start at about $600,000. So that's not a bad price for a Marmel Radziner house, but it's not particularly an inexpensive house.
Right, right.
So,
And you mentioned the auto industry, and this is something that you say in the book. The home building industry in this country makes the auto industry look enlightened by comparison.
Well, you know, at least the automobile industry gets excited about innovation from time to time. You know, at least they do show cars, and they talk about, futuristic and innovative designs, whether they build them or not. And at least with cars, if you don't like what GM is producing or if you don't like what's coming out of Detroit, you can always get, you know, a Toyota or a Mini Cooper. It's a little harder to import a house.
Mm.
But the home building industry is, by and large, pretty stodgy.
Yeah, for a number of reasons. And I'm going to reintroduce you, and then we'll talk about that. Carrie Jacobs is our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. She's an architecture critic, writer, and editor. She is the author of The Perfect $100,000 House, A Trip Across America and Back in Pursuit of a Place to Call Home. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with a question, with a comment, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. We also have a toll-free number, 800-222-9455, 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. And we have a listener waiting to talk with you, Carrie, so let's go and take this call. Line one, a listener on a cell phone. Hi.
Hi. I read your book, which I liked very much. My only disappointment in the book was that there wasn't enough about the prefab homes as opposed to the people who were wanting to build them. But I've been a big fan of Dwell since the first issue, and I'm very much in favor of prefab homes. And I find, because I've been looking around for years to build one, that the problem I have is that whenever I go up on the internet and I look at the prefab homes, and they give you the pricing, but I have no idea how I'm supposed to get the plumber and the person who puts in all the utilities and everything together. In other words, they give you this box with nicely constructed.
Right. Well, I guess the idea with many of these is that you still need to hire a contractor.
But I don't know how to do that. I don't know how to find one I can trust, and I just don't know how. There doesn't seem to be an industry of contractors who do these things.
Yeah, for us ordinary types, for us ordinary guys.
Well, you know, one of the things that Rocio Romero goes out of her way to say on her website is that the house, her kit, is actually, pretty, the construction methods are pretty traditional, and that any contractor who does custom home building should be able to handle it. It would seem like wherever you are, there are always contractors who specialize in custom home building, and whether they're expensive or inexpensive or reliable or unreliable is something that you, I guess, would have to figure out by talking to them and also talking to people you know who maybe have had some experience with them.
Issue that's involved in the money they make and the markup they get if they're not providing the material themselves, even the people who are doing the prefabs. If you go and say, okay, here's my box container that I got off the ship, and I want you to use that. And I just know that's what I wanted, was a $100,000 prefab home, and I had great ideas for it, and I just could never figure out how to possibly get it.
Well, the other things I'd suggest is some of the manufacturers, the prefab people, should be amassing a list of contractors who they recommend at this point. And also, I guess the other thing I could suggest is one of the things that came out of, I mean, my book is not, it's pretty specifically not a prefab book. I wanted to avoid it being that because I was interested in all sorts of methodologies. But I did find that architects who came out of design build programs like the one at the University in Lawrence, Kansas, or Fayetteville, Arkansas, to name a couple, seemed to come out thinking about how much things cost and how to build on a budget in ways that more conventional architects perhaps don't. And so maybe looking around and seeing if there are kind of design build types, in your town might be a way to go, just to get advice and to talk over the matter. I think just talking to as many people as you can is probably a good thing to do.
Yeah. Let's talk with another listener caller in Piatt County on line 4. Hi. Is there a caller there on line 4?
Hello.
Hi there.
Hi. I'm just about to start on the process myself of building, hopefully, the $100,000 dream house. But I've had several people so enthused about straw bale houses because, you know, in Urbana, there is a straw bale house, and I haven't seen it yet. And I just wonder, if it's such a great concept, why aren't there more of them? Is this a valid idea? I mean, I know they were done in Nebraska umpteen years ago, but it just sounds to me like mice, and I don't know.
I don't know if mice is a problem, because the straw bales are usually pretty tightly configured. I'm not really an expert on straw bale construction, and one reason that I don't feature any of them in my book is that this may sound like a shallow reason, but the aesthetics of them are not really to my taste. They have a way of looking a little bit lumpy. Mm-hmm. I think that one problem sometimes with unconventional building techniques is if you need a mortgage, if you have to deal with building inspectors, it sometimes causes more trouble. Or causes trouble, and trouble takes time, and time costs money. So that's, I have nothing against straw bale, really. I think it's a really interesting idea, as is, you know, rammed earth and mm-hmm. and a lot of other alternative methods. But if you're in a situation where you have to deal with a lot of layers of bureaucracy, you may be creating problems for yourself.
Okay. But then would you say the first step would actually be just educating yourself and talking to different people, as you mentioned with the other gentleman, about different contractors, and, I mean, just starting that
way?
Well,
I think you do well, if you're really interested in straw bale, to, you know, find as many examples as you can and talk to the people who, both the people who built them and the people who live in them, mm-hmm. and, you know, find out what it really costs, and, you know, whether there are mice, and, you know, what's involved. And I think the more people you talk to, the better off you are.
Okay, and I'll certainly read your book. Thank you so much for this program.
You're very
Bye.
Welcome.
Bye.
Next, we talk with a listener on line 2, calling us from Gibson City. Hi.
Yes, hello?
Hello there.
Yes, well, I like your idea of open spaces, because we have an adult daughter that's in a wheelchair. And that was my first question, you know, do you deal with handicapped accessibility with your buildings in your book? And then also, I guess my dream is to retire to a nice little log cabin. And if you have anything on, you know, log cabins
The book doesn't really deal with accessibility in that way, I guess in part because it's about a shopping trip for my house, and fortunately that isn't an issue for me. But it does seem like, a good modern home that's all on one level, any good designer at this point should be able to think about what's now called universal design, the idea that a house that is accessible to the handicapped is also more accessible to everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
That's why it's called universal design. I mean, there's a pretty substantial movement, which I'm sorry to say I don't really deal with in my book. As far as log cabins go, they do turn up in my book in funny incidental ways. Like there's a man in in the Seattle area who did sort of prefab log cabins with the waste materials from the plywood industry. But he sadly died a couple of years ago and is no longer making these prefab log cabins. And I guess the only other log cabin mentioned in the book is in Montana, a famous modernist architect named Neutra did a log cabin outside of Bozeman, Montana, which is just sort of an odd, obscure thing. So I don't know if my book would be too much help to someone looking for a log cabin.
Okay, let's take another call. Listener in Edgar County, line 4. Hello.
Good afternoon. Regarding the straw bale houses, the listeners that called in might be interested in talking with the Sisters at St. Mary's of the Woods.
In Terre Haute?
Yes. They have a straw bale home that they built on the campus there, which they use for retreats. And I've been in it, and they, of course, documented everything as they went along. So she would probably be able to find out everything she wants to know about the construction of it, and it's been in existence for over a decade now. So that would give a pretty good history regarding it.
Well, thank you for that call.
And also another thing, have you actually been in Perryville, Missouri?
I was there, yeah. I went to the spot where the LV home, the prototype home, was under construction at the time.
Where is that located? Because I lived across the river in Chester.
I can't give you the precise location, but Rocio Romero does have a website that gives directions.
What is that website?
It's her name, which is spelled R-O-C-I-O-R-O-M-E-R-O, RocioRomero.com.
Okay, R-O-C-I-O?
Correct.
Okay, and so it's in the Perryville.
Yeah, it's you know, on rural land in Perryville.
That's Perryville.
But I couldn't give you directions myself.
The river bottoms of the Mississippi. Also, another home, if you ever have an opportunity and you're back in the Midwest, that was built 50-some years ago, is in Marshall, Illinois, and you're talking about a small home, very compact, but yet at the same time having a lot of features, is the James Jones House.
James Jones.
The writer.
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
It's in Marshall, and he built this in the 50s, and it is has so many built-ins, about the only thing you need is the pool table.
Well, that's the great thing about a lot of those houses from the late 40s and early 50s, is everybody was into built-ins those days, and
And it's a private home, but the people are, you know, very good about showing the house and have kept it. They even have the original stove.
Huh. Well, if I'm ever in the area, I'll look for it.
Okay, very good.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for the call. Let's take another call. Listener in Urbana on line 1. Hi. Caller in Urbana, go ahead.
Good afternoon.
Hi.
For your architect guest, this station does a pretty good job interviewing architects and home efficiency experts from near and far, but from what I see actually under construction just in our local area, some of the very practical ideas never seem to get through to builders. And my pet peeve is those that construct what I call, and other people call, these large McMansions, with no thought to, you know, south-facing glass. And somebody said some years ago when interviewed that the worst thing that this home energy expert said was that the worst thing that she saw was garages on the south side of houses.
That's unfortunate. Yeah.
Yes. So, what is your response? Do you ever talk to contractors? Do you get any feedback if you do? And if so, what might that be?
In the book, I do visit with KB Home, which is a fairly large home builder, particularly in California and the Southwest, and They claim that they design their houses based purely on marketing studies they do. So it's kind of a little bit circular because, of course, they choose the questions and then they design based on the answers. But I don't really think that they ask people whether they would like, you know, passive solar or whether they would object to having a garage on the south side of the house. It's more about, you know, would you pay more for a fireplace? Would you buy a house that doesn't have a basement? That kind of thing. The interesting thing that I have learned last week, I was traveling in the Pacific Northwest doing some book promo stuff, and Vancouver, BC, and Portland are both working really hard not to ban McMansions, but to create zoning and rules that would make it easier for commercial builders to build really small houses. And I thought that that was an important step because they've just created this framework that in certain neighborhoods, under certain circumstances, it makes it easier and perhaps more lucrative for home builders to build a house of, you know, between 1,000 and 1,700 square feet than it might be to build a larger one. And I just thought that that was a step in the right direction. So I don't know if that answers your question at all, but...
Well, but I'd like to put in another 2 cents worth in that if all they build is McMansions, then a large part of the potential market at the lower economic end, say the lower middle class, gets totally priced out, and they can't even get a mortgage.
Well, the other thing, of course, that's happening right now with the real estate bubble deflating is the worth of some of the McMansions may also deflate. They may never have really been worth what they sold for, so that's another part of the story.
Yeah, I want to thank the listener for his call this afternoon. One of the issues here, well, let me use a word to describe it, is the problem that unconventional presents. In terms of financing, and as you mentioned earlier, investment, and then also as home buyers, we're shy of the unconventional. You know, even if I love it, what if nobody else does? What do I do?
Well, there's sort of a primal, the primal fear when buying a house, which is, you know, resale value, and what if I buy it and then nobody wants to pay, you know, what I paid or more, and that tends to reinforce, you know, the demand for more conventional houses. But I'm sorry, I cut you off. Was there a question coming? Or
Well, it's interesting. Let me tell you a quick story.
Okay.
Years ago, my husband and I rented a home that was built for the post World War II market, and it's a pretty nice house, and the neighborhood was terrific. And one of our neighbors, actually, she and her husband bought their home as a young married couple. And they wanted to buy that house. And the bank said, you know, we don't think that these homes are going to last.
Mm.
And so it was tough for them to get financing. And we're back in that same.
Well, that's always the case. Yeah. The bank has a set of rules, but they don't really make up the rules. The rules come from the federal government because most mortgages are bought up in turn by Fannie Mae. And so there is sort of this, you know, layers and layers of hierarchy that make, you know, lending rules for homes. And the architects have gotten very good at sort of fudging or rewriting their house plans to, for example, a house that I talk about in the book called the Shot Trot House in Houston. It was built for a man who is single, and he wanted a one-bedroom house. But the banks wouldn't lend money for a one-bedroom house, so the architect had to designate another area of the house as the second bedroom, you know, whether it ever gets used for that or not. And that's a fairly common thing.
Yeah. And I guess the other question, and it'll have to be my last one, is, you know, is there a market? You know, given that we can be a little shy of the unconventional, is there a market for these $100,000 homes?
Well, I think if they're well designed, they often very quickly turn into, you know, $200,000 homes when they're resold. You know, if they're unconventional in a way that also means that they're somehow shoddy, then maybe not. But I think that many of the architects, many of the homes I talk about actually have, you know, excellent resale value.
Yeah, that's an issue, I think, that is very important to some of us, and that is the quality of the materials that are put into.
I mean, certainly the people that, the houses that I looked at were probably as well built or better built than, you know, more conventional tract houses.
Yeah. There we have to leave it. We're out of time. Carrie Jacobs, thank you so much.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
You're very welcome. Carrie Jacobs is the author of The Perfect $100,000 House, A Trip Across America and Back in Pursuit of a Place to Call Home. The book is published by Viking.